is its computing power.
Yes, but in the calculation, there are
physically. The physical internal state, I'll show you the diagram. We've spoken about difference engines. Now, difference engines, we don't have computation yet. We've still got calculation, right? So this is mechanics. We're 20 past four and we haven't got to computing yet. So what we're going to talk about now is the analytical engine. 1834, Babbage has an idea of a general purpose. We don't know the exact development from the difference engine in Babbage's mind to the analytical engine. We cannot trace the absolute evolution. There are suggestions, there are metaphors, there are things, but we just don't know. So what we're going to look at now is 1834 onwards. So there was a furious period of activity in 1834 and 1847. And I'll expand that diagram. Oops. Okay, that's this bit expanded into there, 1834 to 1847. That's this bit expanded. Early plans, middle plans, final plans. The middle plans are the most revealing. 1840, there is Plan 25, which we will talk about. This is Plan 25. So now we're talking about the analytical engine, general purpose calculator, computing machine that incorporates almost every logical function of the modern digital computer. So, what is going on here? Firstly, there's the separation of the store, the memory, and the mill, which is the processor. So, this is the memory. Each of these, this is a plan view looking down, so each of these circles is a column of figure wheels going down, 40 to 50 long. He calls them variables. We would call them registers now. What he meant by variable is that the numerical value of its contents can change. He didn't mean a variable as we mean it, which is an independent variable, like X. So he called them variables, we call them registers. There are 17 registers shown there. This can extend indefinitely, so the memory can...
A number.
40 to 50 digit number, yes. This is the mill is the central processor. So firstly we have the separation of the store and the mill, which is a piece of von Neumann architecture, is a very classical feature. Now, firstly, the physical scale of this thing. The analytical engine represents a quantum leap in logical complexity and physical scale. The diameter of the central wheel is nearly 2 meters of just that. Now, those are huge gear wheels with teeth around the edges, and they go 40 to 50 deep. This thing is 15 foot high, the depth of this thing. So you're talking about a huge machine. The distance from here to here for 17 registers is the distance it's 18 feet, which is 6 meters. So the distance from there to there for 17 variables is 6 meters. But this is just truncated because it repeats. The minimum machine that Babbage spoke about had 100 variables, and he spoke of machines with 1,000 variables. So you're talking about a machine larger than a locomotive, larger than a locomotive at that time. Right, it's programmable using punched cards. There were various kinds of punched cards. There's the cards there. Some of these cards are very big. Those are the operation cards. We now call them instruction cards. Those cards are something like 26 inches long. That's what 26 inches is 100 centimeters. 26? 8? That's sort of about so long. 6 centimeters, right. Sorry. He designed in imperial measures, not in metric. We have all kinds of logical features. There's buffer registers. So he transfers information. The operation cards, the instruction card says, transfer a piece of information from the memory into the processor, and it goes via those two registers, which are buffer registers. So it has buffering. It stores it temporarily before it needs it. It then circulates itself around here, which I'll talk about very briefly, but it's quite complicated, and then returns it to the store. So the variable card tells it where in the store to fetch it from and where in the store to put it back. The operation card tells it which four arithmetical functions must it perform? So it's got an internal repertoire of functions which it can perform independently through microprograms. So it's got direct division, direct multiplication, subtraction, and addition. And it can do that automatically. You just give it a single instruction, and the microprogram automatically executes multiplication, division, and so on. So you now have a universal machine which you can program that perform any sequence of arithmetical operations. It also has a combinatorial card which will iterate, it will repeat the same sequence of operations a fixed number of times. So by reading a combinatorial card, it will tell you how many times, so you can do iteration. Whether it can do recursion is another question, but it can do iteration, it can repeat.
You say there are two programs, one program for transferring, One card for operation, one card for transfer.
There's data card for information, so it can read in logarithms. A variable card which tells it where in the store it must go. An operation card which tells it what operation to perform.
All this information was on one
card. No, different cards. Operation cards, separate cards, separate card readers. Okay. With fantastically complicated control mechanisms to say what's going on. We're going to build one of these, so we'll understand it. You don't think it's feasible?
But what operation performs a rule?
What operation does it perform? This is a bus. This is like a highway. So this has got wheels, and these are columns of figure wheels. You can transfer any number from any of the wheels to any of the other wheels using the circular bus.
Yes, and during this round,
yes,
you perform one or more operations for each two.
Well, to transfer information is one operation. To calculate is another operation. So these are done in separate parts of the machine cycle. Yes.
You take an information.
Yes, okay. From here, yep.
Bring it
into the drum. Yeah. No, not onto the drum. You bring it into the mill, into the barrel. I'll show you how it goes. It's not simple, but I'll show you the principle of how it works. So, what are we doing here? Okay, one of the crucial things about the 1840 plan is you can extend the memory indefinitely here because it's linear. The earlier plan, Plan 13, you can see it's got a circular arrangement. And so you're limited by the circumference of the circle by how much memory you can have. And so you can see, if you talk about Turing and these endless tape, the idea was that this was, for practical purposes, indefinite. For practical purposes, he can have a memory as big as he likes. And the way the memory communicates is using using a data highway, which is a series of slats which links every column to every other column at digit level. And I'll show you a drawing that shows how that works. They call racks, which are long slats with gear teeth, which operate all the things. Punch cards, that's an example of the operation cards. And that is a set that was, it's 27 cards, I think it's 27 cards. It solves second order partial differential equations. So he actually went through and produced these programs. Question of generality. Jacquard, I'm embarrassed to talk about Jacquard in this organization because you have one of the finest collections of pre-Jacquard and Jacquard looms. But the point about its generality is that there's something very fundamental going on here, and that it's more than just the use of the cards to control the machine that is involved in Jacquard. The idea is the idea of universality, that this is a loom, but it doesn't weave anything very specific. What is product specific about the loom is in the software, is in the cards. And so there's a principle, you have for the first time the notion of a universal machine, a general, which is not a tool. It's not a tool in the sense that it has a single defined function, like a knife. It has what collapses it from a general machine into a tool is the software. And so this principle of generality is actually in the loom already, long before we get to Babbage. And Babbage openly acknowledges that he got the idea of the cards from the Jacquard loom. And of course Jacquard didn't invent it, as we know, but it was the termination of the... Now, this, I thought I'd go back and from, we've done a lot of technological stuff now. What's the opus for? How are we doing? We're okay, I think. there was again the cultural significance. That is the famous portrait of Jacquard woven in silk. Yep. It took 24,000 cards in a Jacquard loom to do this. This is probably familiar to you, the Jacquard portrait. Now, in England at least, Babbage had one of these. In fact, he had more than one. And he used it, and this was used as an argument in England, at least, for to promote the acceptability of the industrial arts. The idea was that the utilitarian, that objects made by machines were crude aesthetically, that they had no aesthetic subtlety. And this was used because of the translucency, the semi-transparency of the drapes and the subtlety of the shading, was to show that aesthetics was not the exclusive province, not the exclusive realm of human agents, that machines could produce objects of beauty. And this was used because of the fineness, and it was often because of the fineness of the weave was often mistaken for an etching. So if you looked at it very closely, people thought it was an etching, and Babbage took great delight in correcting them and saying, no, it's actually woven in silk. And this was used, as it were, to win acceptance for the industrial arts, which at that stage were stigmatized, were regarded as inferior, because aesthetically to artists and craftsmen. Absolutely, absolutely, yes, yes. It replicates expertise, it doesn't replace it, yes. Okay, there's a long list of logical functions. I don't know how meaningful these will be, but I'll run through them because they're quite impressive. Firstly, there's user-level programmability, using punch cards. You can tell it what to do. There's microprogramming at machine level. You can execute these functions automatically. Separation of the store and the mill, they're separate. And he's very clear why he did this, Babbage. Serial operation with a fetch-execute cycle. So it does one thing, fetches machines, fetches information, operates on it, puts it back. Fetches it, a fetch-execute cycle, we call it. Conditional control. It can do branching. If one result, depending on one result, it can take one branch or another branch of a route. It has iterative looping. It can go round and round repeating the same functions. It has pipelining. Doesn't matter what that is. It has buffering. It will temporarily store information. It has an anticipating carriage. So instead of serially doing each decade, it will do them all at once. Internal repertoire of automatic functions. Parallel processing. It can actually split the calculation into two separate parts and operate them at the same time and then combine the results. Parallel data bus, the racks, which I'll show you. Punch card input and output. The outputs were printed, stereotyped punch cards. It also had a graph plotter, so it could actually draw results. That was the conception of the engine. Okay. Just as an example of a card reader, we said how many cards are there. There's a card reader. So that's a fan fold cards go in the box, and there's a prism. And this advances towards these rods. If there's a hole, then it doesn't affect the rod. The rod goes through it. If there's no hole, it activates the rod, and that performs the mechanism. So that's a piece of the store. There are the racks. That's the data highway, the data bus going into the page, and so on. So these are the kinds of drawings that that he left. The most advanced construction of the punch card system is through Meccano by Tim Robinson at the Computer History Museum. Since Babbage, this is the most furthest anyone has gone in building an analytical engine. I don't know why that's there. Okay. This is an example of you saying, how does it sequence? This is called a barrel. This is the microprogram. So you can see that there are studs there, and in the studs there are dowels. Right, those are just blanks, and there's a hole there, and you can put a thing in there. This is how you program the machine. So each of these is a word, in the way we would talk about it now. These words can be 50 to 80 high, so there are lots of them. This barrel could hold 80 words, say. Now what happens is, this barrel moves forward, right, and it either activates these or doesn't activate them, depending on whether there is a stud in one of those words, right? It then advances. These sectors advance the barrel to the next word, automatically to the next instruction. Now, where it goes to is controlled by the last word, but also by conditionals. And there are three separate conditionals that can happen. If there's an overrun, if there's a change of sign, for instance, which is how it does conditional control, then it inserts Okay, so each of these, that can advance this by two, that can advance the barrel by four, by one, by one. Depending on how these are activated, so you can see that if this is activated, it will increase the rotation of that by one, and that will change it. So the point is that the barrel moves backwards and forwards, backwards and forwards, backwards and forwards. It automatically advances each time to the next one, and where it advances to is under conditional control, immediately under conditional control, and also it can respond to latent, to pre-existing conditional controls. For instance, over there, if this thing is moved out, then when the barrel moves forward, it won't activate that thing. If this thing is moved in, the stud there, it'll activate the lion. So that could represent a prior conditional, and when that condition is tested, it moves forward and moves forward. So the barrel can ignore that conditional until it actually comes in. So there's a phase shift. You can shift in time when the conditionals are accessed. So it doesn't matter if the detail of that is not clear. The point is that it's very sophisticated, and he's thought about most of these issues. That's all that exists of the analytical engine. It's under construction at the time of his death. We don't really know a lot about it, even whether it's assembled correctly. But it's something he was clearly experimenting with. We can see the racks, which are the data highway, the thing that moves between the columns of the store. So that's the store, and you can move information between the elements of the store using these racks, which are geared slats. Right, we've been going for about 2 hours, so I should wrap up. Very quickly, you've been very, very patient. Mechanical notation. We've got drawings, and we've got some mechanisms. Babbage, okay. These machines were the most complex machines designed to that time. There are more parts in them than any other machines, and certainly they have a complexity which is unrivaled. We don't know of any other machines that are that complicated for that period. Now the question is, how did Babbage actually manage to keep all this in his head? And he says himself that the trains, the sequence of causal connections, is too complex to be held in your mind. So he was a mathematician, so he used a notation. So he developed a symbolic notation, a language, called his mechanical notation. He was more proud of that than anything else. It's a universal language. It can describe the circulation of blood in birds. It can describe the movement of armies in battle. It's a universal language to describe mechanical things. And for the engines, he used this to optimize the engines. And this, if you like, is what we would now call a hardware description language. And the next time anyone used a hardware description language was in the 1970s, when they were trying to manage the complexity of integrated circuits. Up till that point, it wasn't needed. So the first time there was a machine too complex to contain in your mind, he developed a hardware description language. And the next time, 1970s, they developed a hardware description. That's, again, notations to manage complexity at a high level. So this is the tabular form, and this is the timing form. So you asked, how does this sequence? Babbage divided the cycle not into 360 degrees, but into 50 separate things. So each one is 3 and a bit degrees. Each of these units is. Now, it turned out that the units were too coarse for us to actually get the. This is for the difference engine too. So we turned that into 360 degrees and made it much finer. But this is how Babbage describes the internal organization, the internal orchestration, the timing of the internal thing. So you've got the particular device. There's a sector wheel there and so on and so on. And each of these symbols means something. A dotted line means that that part will move, but it'll move that is dependent on the data, on the value of the number. This says it'll move one interval within that period. A downward arrow says it returns to its rest position. A circle means it's a circular motion. A plus sign means it's moving in the additive direction. So every single symbol in this means something in the notational language. And the final form is, there's a blow up of that. You can see that each of these things, the circle means it's circular, the double arrow means it goes to rest position. That means it moves in the negative position by 3.34 of an inch. And then there's the flow diagram form, which shows the complete separation from the calculating body. That's data, that's control. Separation of data and control. And this is the flow diagram, mechanical notation for the printing apparatus. So that's 4,000 parts, and that is the logical description of it. And you can see there, it says line to line, this stops the engine. That's the halting thing. It automatically detects the end of a page and stops the machine at a particular place. So you can see it's highly sophisticated. I can explain to you, you know, what all the various symbols and things mean, but that's for another time. So he developed an abstract mechanical an abstract symbolic language to describe, to optimize. So if he needed a particular motion, he could tell whether that motion existed somewhere else, so he didn't have to reproduce it a second time. He could derive it from an earlier motion. And he used that to optimize and minimize the execution of the machine. And that's the device of which that is the mechanical notation, that printer, which is the 4,000 parts of the... Okay, so we're nearly done. We now have general purpose calculation. We had dedicated calculation on the difference engine, like a calculator. We then have general purpose calculation, the analytical engine, but still bound by number. The connection from calculation, even general calculation, to computing comes with a realization that number can represent an entity, can represent something other than quantity. That number can represent something other than quantity. So that if a machine can manipulate symbols according to rules, manipulate numbers, but those numbers represent symbols, then that is what the power of the computer is. That if you can have representations of the world in the symbols, and you can give the machine rules by which you can manipulate symbols, you can then get a machine to say something very powerful about the world. Whether or not the grammar is the same doesn't matter, but it can simulate, it can suggest, it can actually find new relationships between entities, provided you have this idea of representation. And that, now for Babbage, right throughout his writings, he always refers to the engines as bound by number, as purposes for mathematics. And my